Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. With so many people appalled at the nature of today's politics and wishing for better leadership, it's interesting to look back at the past and ask if leaders then were in fact better decision makers and more impressive personalities than we see today. Judith Brett, who's had a long academic career and is widely known in particular for her writings on Robert Menzies, has just completed a biography of Alfred Deakin. Deakin was Australia's second Prime Minister and had three separate periods in the job. Deakin has had a very special place in Australian political history as one of the fathers of Federation and a highly respected pioneer Prime Minister in the days before the two-party system had taken over and when the federal scene was one of shifting alliances. Judith Brett is with us today to discuss the man and her book. Judith Brett, let's start with your title, The Enigmatic Mr. Deakin. Tell us about the enigma. What sort of man was he?
Deakin is a bit of a puzzle amongst political leaders, I think. He's in politics from when he's about 22 till he retires in his late 50s. But all the time, he's a little reluctant. He's imagining that he might want to resign or perhaps he should have done something else. So Deakin was a little bit of a puzzle to himself, I think, and he was something of a puzzle to those he worked with in that it was never entirely clear what he was planning to do, particularly in the early period of the Prime Ministership when we had a period of minority governments and Deakin was the pivot in many people's eyes of the success of those governments. And I took the quote actually from something Deakin wrote about himself when he was writing anonymously for the Morning Post, which was a conservative London daily. It was when he was negotiating with Joseph Cook over the coming together of his liberal protectionists with the conservative anti-socialists that George Read had been leading, the free traders. And he wrote, "Mr. Deakin pursues his enigmatic course of action. Nobody's entirely clear what he's planning to do." Now, this is Deakin writing anonymously about himself. He's making himself out to be an enigma. And I also have to say that after 4 years of writing this book, there's still, I wouldn't say that I thought I understood everything about Deakin. There's still something that remains a little enigmatic about him.
Well, just to take up that point of him writing for a London newspaper, this seems so bizarre these days. It's as though Malcolm Turnbull was writing for the Times anonymously and describing his difficulties as a political operator.
Well, I think it was pretty bizarre for then too. I mean, there was more of a practice of politicians who'd been journalists. Deakin had worked as a journalist.
For The Age and David Simon.
That's right, he wrote for The Age. Writing anonymously when they were in politics, but mainly when they were backbenchers. The idea that the Prime Minister of a country is writing about the affairs of that country anonymously at the Imperial Centre, it really was bizarre. And Deakin went to great lengths to make sure nobody knew it was him. He called himself the Australian correspondent. He adopted a Sydney persona. He pretended he supported free trade. He used an alias, Andrew Oliver, for the addressing of mail. You know, so there was a bit of sort of boy's own stuff around this too.
Was he found out at any point?
No, he wasn't found out. It was only revealed to the public in Walter Murdoch's biography. I think a couple of people, Bernard Wise, suspected. But no, his cover was never blown.
Now, in terms of his political skill set, it was a particularly difficult period with the new federation and changing political alliances. How did he operate and how successful was he in managing that situation?
Well, Deakin was a persuader, and I think this operated for him at two levels. One was, I guess, the political skill that got him into politics was that he was a very gifted orator at a time when public meetings are an important, central to political communication.
And talked for hours, literally hours at those meetings.
That's right. He could, you know, he could extemporise and he could work the crowd. And he got a great deal of exhilaration out of that capacity to work the crowd, I think. And a real, you know, he had some of the skills that could have been turned to demagoguery, but he never wanted to. He only wanted to arouse good emotions. or enthusiasm and optimism. But when he's actually operating in a government, in the parliament, it's his skills at persuasion face-to-face that are crucial. Deakin's a very charming man. He's charismatic, I think is the word we would use to talk about him today. People were drawn to him. And he was always prepared to compromise, well, not on everything, but he was always looking for areas of compromise. So I think in managing those minority governments, when the crucial thing was that he had the support of the Labor Party in two of those. Labor is the new kid on the block in Commonwealth politics. It's only, it's really disrupting the established order. And the Labor parliamentarians are finding their feet. Deakin is sympathetic to them. He's courteous. And so that's, I think, the most success, when his government that is the most successful is when it's being supported by Labor. It's not in a formal alliance, but Labor gives him support on some, but not all, of the legislation. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that on all pieces of legislation, the majorities had to be stitched together. Sometimes it was with Labor, but sometimes he could get support from other parts of the House. There wasn't the same hard and fast political divisions that we've become used to.
So he was, to use today's terminology, a man of the sensible centre?
Yes, well, that's where he would see himself. But I think that's true. He saw himself as between the ultras, the ultra sort of Tory conservative obstructionists, and then the part of the Labor Party that was firming up as more ideological, in his terms, rather than focusing on what are the practical, pragmatic pieces of legislation that need to be passed to get the Commonwealth on its feet. The other thing about him, is in terms of political skill set, is he's actually a very able administrator and he's a hard worker. So he does have some backroom skills as well as front of house skills.
Now, one thing reading your book that comes through very strongly is the intensity of his religious preoccupations. He's keeping a prayer diary, and also, of course, this connection with spiritualism, especially in the earlier part of his life. It's very hard to relate to that from the modern era.
Yes, I think, look, the spiritualism is happening in the late 1870s and early 1880s. It's very fashionable amongst intellectuals. It's linked to the decline in orthodox religious belief. People who wanted to still believe in a divine universe, to hang on to the belief in the immortality of the soul, they saw spiritualism as progressive. It was also linked to a set of progressive beliefs. They were much, spiritualists believed in education and rights for women, including political rights. They were against cruelty to animals. They wanted joyful celebrations of the life at funerals. So there was a whole range of beliefs around it. But I think where I would see the way we could link this into today, it gave Deakin a sense, and this is also continues through as his religious life becomes a bit more orthodox, that it mattered what you did with your life, not just for you, you know, what life choices do I have, but in a sense of serving something beyond the self. So when his religious life settles into more orthodox Christian belief, but he never joins a church. He's not interested in religious dogma. He's not interested in religion as a sort of stick for morality. You know, he's not a moralist in that sense. But there is the sense he has that he has been given this one life by God. He's been given great gifts, and I think he's aware of how gifted he is, and that he wants to serve in some way. So I think the link we would make to today would be with the notion of service, of something beyond the self. But he doesn't see that as serving a political ideology or serving a class or serving anything very concrete. It's a sort of rather amorphous notion of service, and he's never entirely sure exactly where he should be directing his energies.
Did you, after your study of him, end up with an underlying psychological theory or interpretation of him?
Not entirely, but I did have a psychological framework for the book, which was really Erik Erikson's notion of the life course and the way in which there are different challenges and tasks that face us as we go through life. And in particular, for Deacon, I think the sort of midlife crisis was crucial. He's in his late 30s, early 40s, when marvellous Melbourne comes crashing down with the land boom, and there's a series of rolling financial disasters in the early 1890s. Deacon had this amazing rise to prominence through the 1880s, and in the early 1890s resigns from ministerial office and he sits on the back bench. And he's really unsure what to do with his life. He's a man who's an optimist, and it was hard to be optimistic in Victoria at that time. So I did use that notion of some sort of crisis in his life about what to do with his life and his gifts, coinciding with a crisis in the colony of Victoria. And I think that gives the sort of energy for the achievements that were to come, which were his contribution to Federation, which becomes something of a redemption project for him, I think. That's, you know, Victoria's made a mess of things, but Federation is something that stands as a progressive cause. And also the energy that he brings to the early years of the Commonwealth. He says, those of us who've argued for Federation have got a responsibility to make it work. And that's my sense of of the core of his commitment in those early prime ministerships of his, which is to make the Commonwealth work, to do whatever it is to make it work. Because I now think that those first 5 or 6 years were much more tenuous than we realise. We tend to think, you know, there's Federation and then they just got on with it. But the states were arcing up quite early. You know, they realised how much power and prestige they'd lost. There was the expense of a new layer of government at a time when the country was coming out of a very severe drought. So West Australia wasn't that enthusiastic. And, you know, later on we know it wanted to secede, and some of them think that's still a good idea. So that's the psychological theory. I mean, I did toy with the idea of theories of narcissism, but narcissism, I think, in politics is now become so much of an overused word, I don't think it's very helpful for us. People think it just means sort of self-centred rather than meaning looking at the whole range of ways in which people can use the energies of their self for greater things.
Now, you spoke of him working very hard. I wonder if you were making a comparison between his workload and Malcolm Turnbull's workload, the contemporary Prime Minister's workload, how would it go? Of course, bearing in mind that Deacon was a Victorian, the Parliament in those days was in Melbourne. He does seem to have spent quite a deal of his time at the Beach House. Was it really as intense as now?
No, I don't think it was, Michelle. I mean, there's not the 24/7 demands of the media. The range of policy issues are smaller. It's a smaller, simpler society. I mean, when he's involved in election campaigns, that is pretty arduous work, I think. That you're on a train, sleeping overnight, getting out, shaking hands, doing an address, perhaps at the railway stations as you go through, you know, the sort of whistle-stop tour idea, going to a mayoral lunch. That was very exhausting. But Deacon was somebody who needed periods of intense reflection. And I've wondered about this: would he be able psychologically to survive a person like him in today's world? When you were asking me about the psychological theories, when I did the work on Robert Menzies, and also I taught a course on political biography, I used to think that politicians tended to be people who didn't have very complex inner lives on the whole. They projected, they externalised, they dealt with problems out there on the world. Deacon wasn't like that. He really needed time apart to reflect on things that were actually not much to do with politics. I mean, he'll be reading comparative religion or reading the Quran, or it's not as if he's going home to read policy papers. Now, he's doing that sometimes, but, you know, he has a 6-week break over the summer. So I think there is much less intensity. And I suppose the other thing I'd say is, you know, there's a cost to the intensity of today in terms of the types of people who can actually survive it.
So you don't think he'd fare all that well in today's world?
Well, I think that that personality type where you need periods of solitude would have a hard time. Now, people are made by the times they, you know, he would have grown up in a different age. He would have been more used to media. It's a bit hard to say.
So are the lessons for contemporary politicians from Deakin? And I note that the Liberal Party always refers back to Menzies, I suppose because of his period so much closer. They don't refer back to Deakin.
No, I think that's partly because Deakin's become associated in the contemporary political memory with a set of policies, the policies that Paul Kelly called the Australian settlement, white Australia, tariff protection, state paternalism, compulsory arbitration and conciliation and imperial benevolence. And these are the policies which the reforming agenda of the 80s, picked up by both the Liberals and Labor, overturned. And I think the things he's most associated with are basically white Australia and tariff protection. And what I would argue, and have argued in the book, is it's not really to his policies that we need to look for his legacy so much as to his statecraft and the commitment he had to making the institutions work. Like when in the early parliament, when he's Attorney General, the High Court is written into the Constitution, but the Parliament decides that it will be too expensive and they can just put it off. And Deakin fights tooth and nail to get the High Court established because he says that's absolutely crucial to the way the Constitution is going to operate.
But a bargain basement one, it only had three judges in those days, didn't it?
Yes, but that was an achievement because they wanted to just have some rotating state Supreme Court judges for a while, you know? So I think that the Liberal Party, having so decisively turned itself away, particularly from protection and from arbitration, I mean, it also doesn't own Justice Higgins in any way, it's put Deakin into that box. And so it looks like it acts as if everything started with Menzies, which is quite wrong because Menzies pays great tribute to Deakin and when he calls the Liberal Party after Deakin's Liberal Party. And he also at various points, you know, says that Deakin lays the foundations.
Now, just before we finish, I want to turn to a completely different topic because during the recent housing affordability debate, I was really interested in your writing and speaking on the importance of home ownership in Australia and the implications if that declined significantly. Can you just tell us something of your argument here?
Yes, well, I've been, as many people of my age, you know, I'm a baby boomer. We got our house pretty easily. Houses were cheap then in relationship to wages. And looking at my children, my children's generation, who are people in their early 30s, and other people I know through work, for whom housing affordability has become a major problem. And for me, owning a house was like having control over my life and having a future and a place in which, I mean, I feel deeply identified. I've lived in the same house for 38 years, deeply identified with that house. And that a house is not just about economic value, that it has deep psychological value, not for everybody, but for a lot of people. And it's the way they imagine their lives. And I feel as if what's happened is it's like we're robbing young people of their future lives. And particularly when this is combined with the casualisation of work, which is really impacting on people under 40. I just feel that it makes me really angry and very sad that the country that gave me such a great start and where it was so easy to buy a house has turned, it feels like it's turned its back on younger people, and I feel very angry with, well, both parties in a way, but particularly the Liberal Party, where they were thinking about doing something about negative gearing. It was pretty minor. Labor comes out with another fairly minor change on negative gearing, and the Liberal Party drops it immediately because brand differentiation has become more important to them than actually solving problems. And to link that back to Deakin, I mean, for Deakin, brand differentiation, if you like, was never an issue. He always said you have to put the policy, you've got to put the policy before the needs of the party. And if you in a way weaken your party's identification because to get the policy outcome you want, well then the policy is really what we're here for. And I feel that's certainly been lost in the housing debate and in the real failure, I think, of our political class to do anything really effective about it. And it's being lost again in the wrangles over a clean energy target.
Judith Brett, thank you very much for talking with us today and congratulations on your book. It's a magnificent achievement. I hope it goes really well. That's all from our politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back with another interview soon. Goodbye for now.